Anyone want to share? Was there a benefit in doing this? Was that helpful?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what's the conclusion? let's hear this simply group over here. You want to say Sherry or Carl or?
How did this start? We were talking about
the stuff.
Stuff.
Shoes.
Yeah. My shoes. I'm one of the people with 100 pairs of shoes. My attachment to them. And then I think one of the other common things for all of us was around sort of reputation.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us are kind of, the work that we do requires us to have a certain level of expertise.
That's
and
right.
So for us, it's kind of like, you know, you do the best you can in what you do, but you want other people to recognize that as well, because we are like experts in the work that we do. And then it started going on to martial arts and training, and then the number of weapons that Carl has, owns, and whether he is attached to them himself or not. then that's kind of where we ended it.
And what about the next group, Zed and Pauline?
Yeah, well, we started off, I started off on judgment.
Mm.
How you just judge people and assume and not, you know, sometimes not even give anyone a chance.
Particularly when that comes in the form of racism.
Actually, we didn't hit on racism, did we?
Yeah, I mean, how much, you know, you think you're not a racist, but then it's there, isn't it?
Completely.
You know, completely, you know, we're all Caucasian people, except for you, but Asians are sort of, it's funny, you know, Caucasians have less prejudice against Asians, it seems to me, than they do against, I mean, Far East Asians, than Near East Asians or Africans. I don't know, it just seems, maybe it's because we grew up more with them, or they're in the same, I don't know, but it just seems that, I mean, have you experienced a lot of racism in your life?
I wouldn't say negative racism, because there's a lot of, like, sort of stereotypes about Southeast Asian people.
Yeah.
Are not in their, maybe a bit demeaning, but in terms of, like, certain ideals around intellect and success and things like that are not as negative, I think, as other people from other cultures.
Yeah.
But it's still there. It's still sort of underlying. And I think, I know my having discussions with colleagues and classmates once before, it's sort of seen as kind of a light, racism light, as we call it.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah.
Light. So it's not negative sessions, but it's still like kind of name calling or, you know, shouting things.
Stereotypes too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There is a theory that we're in the process of incorporating Asian people, particularly Far East Asian people, South East Asian people, into the concepts of whiteness. Actually, there's this process going on at the moment, which, you know, is how you end up with, you know, racism, light, and things like that. Because compared to, there's a process of kind of not assimilation but incorporation.
Mm-hmm.
That close enough to us.
Starting to see.
And I think some of shared values makes a difference.
Yeah.
Like they're not Puritan ethic, but they work hard and they try to go to university and they want good jobs, and not that others don't, but there's just something, I don't know what it is, you know.
You know,
I mean, racism's a big one, though, isn't
it? But I worked in the NHS in London.
Yeah.
And what I used to be amazed at is that the racism was black on black.
Mm.
They're Ghanaians, and the night, because a lot of health visitors that, and those kind of nurses work with children are either Ghanaian or Nigerian. And I used to sit in the middle of it all and think, oh, wow, because it's usually, because people think it's just white to black who are racist. Because I also live in a very black area in London, and it's definitely both ways. So I think that
it's just really, isn't it? It's about, when we think about me and mine, it's my tribe. Tribalism is so ingrained, you know. It's more about, you know, you're not from my tribe, and I think that's just in our DNA. Like self-cherishing is in our DNA, which is, or self-preoccupation is in our DNA, which is why it's so hard to overcome, because it's just part of our hardwire. You know, it's not something we learned from our parents. We're born that way.
evolutionary biology.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so hard to get rid of.
Yeah.
And it operates on the level of our epistemology, like the way the knowledge systems we have there. I work in a cross-cultural environment where
yeah.
it's about the biggest difference you can possibly have in,
yeah.
in knowledge systems.
Yeah.
And it's a constant reminder of just the assumptions I have about how the world works and how I as
mm-hmm.
it comes back to that, I operate
yeah.
within it. It's just completely different
mm.
and there's not really that common ground.
Yeah.
So you're constantly having to negotiate yeah. and be aware of your own assumptions. It's quite a healthy environment to work
mm.
in, even though it can be
mm.
stressful on both sides at times,
mm.
because, and I consider it part of my Dharma practice, really, because I'm constantly being, getting these, oh, okay, yep, no, I think that's actually not right, you know, that's
yeah.
not right in that context, because someone else thinks differently, and so it's a constant
mm-hmm.
dialogue that often butts up
yeah.
against each other.
I think that was one of the biggest things in the beginning of my Dharma practice, when the light bulb went on. I went, wow, that person doesn't think that way at all about that. And that's okay. You know, that would think that was the thing, is that their concept, you know, they
mm-hmm.
it's like, you know, they'll see one situation have a completely different spin than mine. And up until then, I thought I was, I was like the only way, you know. And you can see that. And then I realized, wow, you know. Other people's values are just as equally right to them, and somehow we have to find tolerance for all of that, which is why it's so difficult, isn't it? But it all comes down to, you know, this me thing, right? No matter what it is, it starts there.
I think part of it's also not beyond the individual as well, but, well, it's not the individual values, but also sort of our own self-sense of validation by
mm-hmm.
having a community.
Mm-hmm.
And there are these people who feel the way that I do, who have the same upbringing as
mm-hmm.
I do, and that sort of validates oneself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also part of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the individual, but there's also the sense of
mm-hmm.
belonging and community. That's
yeah, and we always choose like-minded people to be around if we have a choice, isn't it? Yeah. So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Judgment. Okay, what else besides judgment was there? Did you come up with? Sid?
No, we talked about cynicism as well,
mm.
which is the kind of big one for me, and I find that if I'm in a place of that real grasping or like maybe like physical pain or something, then one way I try and get out of it is just to really not have or not feel the possibility for change in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Or have faith or kind of hopefulness,
mm.
and I find that kind of cynicism to be quite toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think for me that to be able to be vulnerable in those moments
mm-hmm.
probably would be a better tactic.
Mm.
But
mm. Your vulnerability is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We should thank you, and then maybe move on to. Who was the other group? You. Oh, wait. Oh, there. I didn't see Richard. I was wondering where the third person was. Yeah. And you guys, what did you talk about? I'm sure you talked about more, but we can talk more at the discussion, maybe.
I think we covered some of this already, but maybe one that particularly Amanda and I were thinking about was sort of not being vulnerable, not being, like, self-sufficiency.
Mm-hmm. And describe that a little
yeah.
more.
This kind of needing to be self-sufficient.
Oh yeah.
So as to not rely on others,
mm-hmm.
to not sort of to mitigate the possibility of being hurt or
mm-hmm.
having things taken or not
mm-hmm.
having enough.
Mm-hmm. And does that come from needing a sense of safety from prior life experience, or do you think you're just born that way? Maybe it doesn't matter, does it? Yeah. And anything else you want to say, Glenn? Richard? Anything?
I rely on this kind of, I guess I call it intellectual arrogance, the amount of distress it caused me when somebody doesn't agree with me without good reason, like talking to a climate denier person. That's why I'm incredibly distressed. Because, of course, I know I'm right.
Yeah.
How can we not when it's so obvious? Right? How can we not when it's so obvious?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but you know, I mean, I used to think that way too, but how can, I mean, also my just basic emotions, you know, I mean, how, I think I, for the longest time, I didn't understand about the greediness of, you know, people in power and stuff. And then I realized, you know, I have big blind spots too. And just because, you know, I can see theirs, I still can't see mine. So that's why we're all the same, you know, and that we're all still have all this selfish activity going on all the time, you know. Me. You know, and just these involuntary reactions of anger or jealousy or, you know. So how can I really judge anybody else, because I've still got it too. It might not be as obvious, but, you know, still there. Yeah. And that's helped me to have a lot more compassion and tolerance for those kind of people. You know, it's like, rather than it's you idiot, it's like, oh, you poor thing. How about this group? Lisa? Or Keith? Or?
Well, we started off, it's a bit, main thing for me is distractions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where just filling up every single hour of the day with something to stop you. So you don't have to think. You don't have to think. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have any thoughts because you're always reading or, you know, doing something.
Yeah. And sometimes you actually sit down to do something and you wish to do it. But then you're suddenly in another room doing something else. Because it's just, you know.
Yes.
And some of it's procrastination, but some of it is just this allowing these distractions to come in. And sometimes even you're aware, it's like myself with sweet things.
Mm-hmm.
If I buy a packet of biscuits, if I don't open them, everything's fine.
Mm.
If I open them, the whole lot's gone.
Mm.
Very quickly, you know. And I would be conscious saying to myself, well, you know, that'll last me 2 or 3 days.
Mm.
2 hours later, biscuits are gone.
I think everybody's like
so that. So you have that awareness, but you allow it to happen.
Yeah, well, you know, part of that distraction thing, I think, to give yourself a break, is that, it is to give yourself a break, but I mean, like a break in seeing critical, is that when you have a really kind of a intense life, you know, when you do have a moment, it's kind of a way of self-nurturing to be distracted, don't you think?
Yes,
you know, it's kind of of a reward. It's like
the biscuits. They also
it's kind of a sense of self-rewarding, and so maybe it's not. I mean, it might be better if you weren't like that, but I think when you know, well, the thing is, if we want to change something, we can never change it if we label it bad.
Mm.
You know, because then it's like there's a resistance, you know, in your mind, you know, oh, I shouldn't be doing that, that's not a good thing. But if we can just kind of accept it, oh yeah, that's right, I need to be distracted now because I just spent 5 hours on the computer working, you know, and so now I need to do something to sort of unwind my mind. And that kind of thing is I think, not so bad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can, you know, do enough of that, then maybe you can get to the place where you kind of rest, but in a way. And I think that's one of the reasons why everybody's so busy these days with their telephones and stuff, is because when they're doing what they're required to do, it's so intense now and so much of it, you know, that when it finally stops, it's like the mind needs something to do to unwind. It can't just stop. You know, you need to play. It's like a form of play, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so in a way, we need to allow ourselves to play. And recognize that's what I'm doing. I need to play right now. And then, okay, playtime's over, you know. Because it's like if everything we do is kind of like a will, you know, we're willing ourselves to work. You know, I'm willing myself to take care of this child. I'm willing myself to do this meditation. And so, you know, it's like your do button needs a break. You know, it's like, oh, I just can't make myself do anything more. And so then you fall back into whatever is kind of pleasing, whether it's eating biscuits or, you know, watching a movie or whatever it is, you know. And I think that rather than think that's a bad thing, it's like, oh, it's just a result of the world we live in. And until we can consciously restructure our lives, you know, and I think unfortunately for most people now, it's probably not until they retire. You know, I mean, it's just the way the world is developed. It's unfortunate, but that's part of these degenerate times, is that everything is so you know, work. Maybe yours is a little more open because you're traveling and stuff, and yours as a therapist, you have time between patients, you know. But some people's lives are just like that, you know, until you retire or something. And then it's just like habit making, new habits. You know, how else can I play? You know, what else can I do that nourishes me? That's a little more health. You know, a little more nourishing than what my, you know, unconscious need tells me. So I don't know. Because I know we're all like that, and I think it's okay to give yourself permission to do that to a certain extent. You know.
Yeah, I think it's creating the balance is the key.
Yeah.
And for me, it's not balanced at the moment.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
I've suddenly realised I've been on the computer for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Not really taking anything in, so it's just numbing the mind more than anything.
Yeah.
So I don't beat myself up about it. In fact, usually I find it quite humorous. You know, I'm just suddenly 3 or 4 hours is just gone.
Especially on a computer, it's so easy to get lost.
It is.
In it.
Yeah. So it's just that balance.
Yeah. Anything else besides that?
And we talked about reputation again, and how we feel if we're criticised.
Mm. Nobody thought about getting angry? Nobody here gets angry?
Well, we talked about avoiding confrontation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course we talk about
that. Yeah.
We avoid confrontation.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I bet. The one with ADHD.
Yeah. I just snapped. That's why I could change.
Yeah. Well, I would think so, too. It's very difficult, isn't it?
I've got in that cycle of do something, or I walk through the door, and I'm always going...
Yeah.
I'm like that way, trying to do something which I know he's going to do.
Well, maybe the discussion, I'd like to give us something to think about between now and then. Let's think about how we could help or deal with anger. You know, what are good ways to try to release that, you know, because it's really hard.
We're in a horrible, horrible cycle. And
yeah.
Me, that needs to change to get out of it, but I don't know how to do it.
Yeah. Because that's really, especially if it's someone you love that you're getting angry with, it's really a great source of suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I mean, just some of the most basic ones, you know, pride. That's reputation's pride and, you know, being overwhelming attachment for people and places and, you know, those kinds of things. And, any time, you know, the definition of a delusion, I think, is any moment of mind that arises from inappropriate attention that causes the mind to be unpeaceful. And so there's two factors there. There's inappropriate attention, which we don't really have much attention anymore, you know, and then anything that causes the mind to be unpeaceful. So that's you know, any time you're like, you know, that's some kind of delusion, and it's good to turn around, what is that? Why am I like that? You know, what's going on here? And rather than go and play, you know, you might want to just have a look. But sometimes, you know, getting distracted is the best thing to do, you know. And so I think we'll end soon, but I think the other thing we need to think about is not only what they are, but, you know, what's the disadvantage? You know, why is it that we want to let go of these? You know, I mean, the obvious answer is, of course, we want to get enlightened, you know, but how is it that these destructive emotions are destructive? What makes them destructive, you know? Does anyone, besides it making the mind unpeaceful, what else does it do? What else does it do?
Create harm to others.
Yeah, it causes disharmony, doesn't it?
Suffering.
And suffering to ourselves and others. Yeah.
If we really try to understand what benefit they bring to us, then it's easier for us to understand the nature of why we're clinging to them so much.
Yeah.
So it's really important to understand what is so precious. What do they feed?
Those delusions.
Delusions. Yeah.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
What's the benefit? What reward are we getting from our delusion? And are we getting any reward, or is it just something that happens because we have no control over it? You know, have you ever thought about that? Yeah.
For me, I try and see what these strong emotions might be communicating before kind of trying to dismiss them outright.
That's a really good point.
Especially with like anger, for example, I'm just so blind to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only when I got into a relationship that I realised, oh, it's my partner doing all of the anger for both of us in the relationship. And it just needed that kind of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That I had to actually experience it first,
mm-hmm.
anger, desire, whatever. I couldn't just say, oh, you know, I'm Buddhist, I shouldn't be experiencing.
Right, I think that's a really good point, because that's why the things we talked about yesterday, you know, it's really important to let ourselves understand the root of that anger, you know, and see if we can work with that, you know, the cause of the anger, you know, what is it, why am I getting angry, you know, is it just because it's a bad habit, or is it touching something else in me that needs to be healed, that needs to be looked at, because there's, you probably, he's our resident psychologist, there's another psychologist named, what's his name, Harville Horrocks, you know him, he wrote the book Getting the Love You Want, and it's about relationships, and his theory in relationships is that the things that that your partner upsets you are the things in yourself that need to be healed. So every, you know, the things that are upsetting you are the things you need to look inside and think, oh, that's what I, you know, if I didn't have that trigger, it wouldn't upset me. So what is it inside me, you know? And I think they're able to talk, I think the method is you sit down and talk about it. But, yeah, but also you think about it, it turns people into enemies, doesn't it? We don't want necessarily people to be enemies. I mean, people who criticize us or put the blame on us or do things just we don't like. I mean, I'm still working on people, you know, like big things that happened to me. I mean, I still, when I think of that person, I feel, you know, that even though it was 10, 15 years ago, still I don't trust that person. The label enemy comes up. And although I might in my mind think, oh, yes, there's suffering, seems to me, I care for them. But I don't trust him. and maybe that's not a bad thing, you know. But still, it has. I've allowed that person to become my enemy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then where's the equanimity there, you know. So, and also, you know, it stops us from being happy, doesn't it? Just simple happiness. We're not happy, you know. And think about the idea of, you know, the karmic consequences of it, you know. It's like, we're creating every time we do that, we're creating the cause to continue to do that. You know, it's like it's an endless circle. We can't stop. You know, it's a, what they call, negative feedback loop, you know. One moment of anger will lead to another moment of anger, you know. And I think, too, for me, and maybe you feel this way, too, I used to, like, let my thought have an angry thought about somebody or something, but I wouldn't say anything. But what I realized is if I actually even let myself think something negative about somebody, at some point down the road, it's that thing we talked about yesterday, I'm going to tell somebody. You know, it's going to come out. Wasn't it you that said, I'm going to go somewhere and talk about it to somebody else? And so I realized that I even have to stop myself from thinking about what this person did to me. You know, and immediately think, this was, you know, I created the cause for this to happen, you know. Because it's so sneaky, you know, that self-cherishing mind, you know.
But then, if you actually say, okay, I'm not going to think about it, you're 400% you will think about it.
Yeah.
And the only way you can turn this actually is to either allow the space, I mean, and then or to try and think of something, or to try and direct those energies or something.
Exactly.
Else.
Yeah, it's true.
As soon as you try not to, you will think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know. Just a couple of years ago, I was having a really hard time with a woman, and we'd have these interactions, and I would just get so upset. And I would just have a prayer wheel. I'd just come home and turn my prayer wheel, and meditate on Tonglin with her,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just do Tonglin over and over and over again, until my upsetness, my anger, you know, would subside. So I wouldn't stop it from happening, but I had to let it, you know, I had to do something with it. And it was, but it was interesting to see. I mean, sometimes I'm 15 minutes. But it did work. It really worked, you know. And now, even though, you know, the people that still I have some kind of enemy thing about, you know, but with her, and it was a big enough deal that I could have, I don't. You know, like when I think about her, I don't have any, I just think love for her, you know. Even though it was a pretty serious thing that was going on, you know. And so I can see that you know, there has been some progress made, you know, in that we can transform negative things, you know, if we just exactly like you said, it's like you don't deny it, you don't push it away, but you just work with it. And for me, the Tonglen is just the best thing, you know.
I think it's good as well to actually recognize that, and I find it's in the past, I would go and seek that person out and thank them.
Oh, that's really
for
good.
Changing my life,
mm-hmm.
and for, you know, making me think. And it's amazing what results that happen, because they suddenly see you in a different light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I particularly had quite a lot of problems with bullies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't think why they were bullying me and things. Mm-hmm. And then learning a bit about Buddhism and the reality of mm-hmm. things. And then I thought, wow, they've been my friend, they've helped me.
Amazing. And you really can sincerely feel that way, can't you?
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it?
And that's forgiveness, and
mm-hmm.
forgiving yourself,
mm-hmm.
forgiving them,
mm-hmm.
but telling them that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't always happen, you don't always
mm-hmm.
have to do it, but it really helps me to do that.
That's a very good point. Then that takes courage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also really forgiving them. There might be a little bit of part of you that hasn't really forgiven them, you know, until you say that, isn't it? Well, that's wonderful. So, yeah.
I think it's just really important to be able to highlight that space of being able to feel the anchor or the emotion, because I don't know, for me, I don't know maybe for others, if you've had, say, if you've been abused or you've had a really strong
mm-hmm.
kind of difficult thing happen, then
mm-hmm.
maybe the tendency is just to totally repress it.
Exactly.
And so it's kind of bypass that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just saw a really touching documentary about the Isle of Lewis. Who was I talking about? Someone went to go to the Outer Hebrides. It was you. And in 1946, Christmas of 1918, when all the boys and men from World War I were finally coming home, and Lewis only has like 19,000 people and 6,000 men left. Maybe it was 21, they had 21,000. Anyway, it's a big population, I can't remember. And the British Navy, there were like 350 men waiting on the dock at the Kyle of the Kalsh in Skye, waiting to go to Lewis. And the British Navy only sent a boat for 200 people. And they all really wanted to go home. So someone showed up with a boat to take them that wasn't adequate enough, and maybe you could only hold 100 people, but so 150 men got on this boat. And within about 50 yards from Lewis, it ran into a rock and crashed. And almost all of them drowned. And one of them was able to, got the wherewithal to jump off the boat with a rope tied to him, and he swam to shore, and he held, even though it broke his ribs, he stood on the shore with the, as one by one the servicemen were holding onto the rope to get to the shore. But then the boiler exploded and all the rest of them died. And one of the, I mean, it's a very interesting documentary, and one of the things that they had a psychologist on at the end, and he said, it just cast a dark shadow over Lewis for two generations because nobody talked about it. They don't talk about it. And the thing about PTSD is that if you don't talk about it, it stays with you. So that's really what you're saying is very important. And, you know, there were like women who never wore anything but black for the next 60 years, you know, because it seemed like every village in Lewis was affected. And so it just put this dark shadow on Lewis that they're just now coming out of, because the people are dying, you know. But still, they passed it on, you know, and that kind of closed down depression, because so many of the men who did return were depressed, you know. But anyway, they had PTSD from World War I, and they hardly even knew what that was back then. And so,
survivor guilt.
Yes, survivor guilt. But not only survivor guilt, but just whatever happened in World War I, you know. It was such a horrible thing. But I just to me really drove home the thing that you can't ignore traumas. You know, you really have to talk about them and share them, you know, and be heard. And I think one of, you know, the things about myself that I'm still working on is this, what Thich Nhat Hanh calls compassionate listening. You know, because I know in my family, you know, there were four kids and we'd all sit around the dinner table and kind of compete to say who, you know, who had what to say. And I still sort of have that habit. You know, it's like I'm not patient enough and waiting to get my turn to say something sometimes. And I know that it's just so important just to listen. You know, you don't need to say, I don't need to say anything, you know. I can just listen to somebody's story. And Thich Nhat Hanh has done a lot of work with Vietnam vets. And maybe you know about that work, but that's what all they do. They sit around in a circle, they meditate together, and then they let him tell their story with a witness that everybody listens. And that heals the PTSD. You know. So never underestimate, don't, you know, it's really important to share, you know, what's going on. Yeah. So let's dedicate. And we'll take a 20-minute break. Let's see what's happening here. I think we went over way over time. No, that's okay. We still have, it's already 10:45. But I think just a 20-minute meditation is fine, you know. As you said, you know, you don't need to meditate too long. So why don't we come back at about 10 after 11, and we'll do a 20-minute, another tonglen meditation. Is that all right for 20 minutes? Okay. So we can just do the dedication. And thank you, everybody, for sharing. By this merit may I become Buddha. Right here.